So actually, what I'm going to talk about is sort of an inter. It's going to involve an interplay between two different types of questions. Somewhat different types of questions. The first question is is a very practical question. It's the question of developing numerical renormalization group methods, highly accurate numerical renormalization group methods for quantum mechanical systems in two or higher dimensions. And of course, this is a problem of great interest because, as Mike pointed out yesterday, currently we really have no method for addressing many, many quantum mechanical systems in, for example, 2+1 dimensions, because they suffer from something called the Fermi sign problem. And so we can't address them using Monte Carlo, which is basically the only method we have currently. So that's a question of some kind of practical interest. The other question I'm going to talk about is sort of more theoretical interest, which is trying to understand the emergence of topological order. And hopefully this talk, I'm trying to show that these two questions are actually somewhat related, and I think they can help sort of inform each other. Okay, everything I'm going to talk about was done in collaboration with Cody Nave, who's a student at MIT. Okay, so the first thing I want to do is what's the basic issue that I'm trying to discuss here today? So imagine you have some kind of quantum spin system that's in a topological phase. Then what does that really mean? Well, what that really means is that when you look at the system at long distances, you'll see various signatures of topological order. You'll see fractional statistics when you try to braid the particles around. You'll see ground state degeneracy when you put the system on a torus. So at long distance, you'll see this beautiful mathematical structure that people have talked a lot about in this conference, a topological quantum field theory. But what do you see when you look at short distances? When you look at short distances, you see nothing. You see a mess. You may see just spins with some, could be very complicated interactions. You see no signature whatsoever of the topological order. So, I mean, topological order is really fundamentally an emergent phenomenon. And in some sense, I would say it's sort of much more so an emergent phenomenon than, for example, traditional symmetry breaking order. So what do I mean by that? Well, let's think about for a second what happens if we have a system that's, say, has some kind of symmetry breaking order. We can immediately recognize that order by just measuring. Let's say we have like an icing magnet that orders. Then the symmetry breaking order becomes apparent even on the lattice scale. You just measure the spin at a single point, and you suddenly see that it's broken the up-down symmetry. So symmetry breaking order is something which appears even at the lattice scale. But this isn't the case for topological order. For topological order, the only kind of signature you can get involves, say, braiding quasi-particles around. But quasi-particles have a finite size given by the correlation length. And so there's basically no way you can detect topological order without looking at some kind of string-like correlation like I've drawn here with some width given by the correlation. So the topological order only appears once you go to this longer length scale. And I think this is actually a real problem because it makes it very hard to probe topological order. So for example, let's imagine you have a numerical simulation where you have some quantum spin system or fractional quantum Hall system that's in a topologically ordered state, and you want to know is it topologically ordered? You want to know what kind of topological order does it have? How do you tell? Now, this could be somewhat difficult because there isn't a simple operator you can measure, something you can measure on the lattice scale. You can put the system on a torus and measure degeneracy and so on, but you're really restricted with what you can do. It's even harder to predict topological order. So given some microscopic Hamiltonian to predict whether it has topological order or what kind. And again, I think that has to do with this emergent aspect, which is that unlike in symmetry breaking order, where we have like a local signature symmetry breaking order, which is say the expectation value of SZ, there's no such local operator we can write down a topological order. So we can't do any kind of mean field theory, for example. So there's no way to even, first, or at least very limited ways to even estimate whether we have a system that's in topologically ordered. Really, the only systems that we understand in a quantitative way are these exactly soluble models that people have talked about a bit the last couple of days, which is they're called Torreya-Vairot models, or alternatively string net models, depending on the context. And these are models really where, in some sense, this whole emergence issue doesn't show up, because these are models where they basically have where the correlation length is exactly the lattice constant. In other words, all these string operators here, they become just a line. They have no width. All the signatures of topological order actually occur at the lattice scale. You don't have to go to longer scales. So really, you can only address this situation where there is no emergence. Okay, so that's the problem I want to try to address. And one way that you could imagine trying to address it, the approach I want to take, is basically a real space normalization group approach. So the idea here is, roughly speaking, we imagine we do some kind of coarse graining transformation on our, say, quantum lattice model. And if we do this, we repeat this coarse graining transformation many, many times, we would expect that sort of we're starting from some generic messy model with a long correlation length, it'll flow after a long period of time to some kind of fixed point with a short correlation length. And from this fixed point, we could then easily find out what kind of topological order the system has, and so on. And you know, a reasonable expectation for what these fixed points are is that they're going to be some kind of Torreya-Vairot or string net-like models, because as I said, these are models which have basically zero correlation length, so they're sort of the natural candidates for some kind of fixed point. Okay, so this is what I want to talk about, and the way I'm going to do it is most of my talk I'm going to be describing a way to approach this problem in 1+1 dimensions. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to describe a basic renormalization group method in 1+1 dimensions, and I'm going to explain the physical picture for this method and how it relates to other methods like DMRG. And I'm going to use this method to sort of study the emergence of topological like order in 1+1 dimensions. I'll classify fixed points and try to understand how different kinds of order can emerge. And then in the last few minutes, I'll just speculate about generalization to 2+1 dimensions, where we can see explicitly that the fixed points are these exactly soluble models that I mentioned here. So the fixed points are exactly these Torreya-Vairot type models. So one thing I should say before I go further is that a lot of this is work in progress. So basically everything from, halfway through here down is definitely work in progress. So I really want comments and questions and things, because it's not at all settled. So first thing I want to mention before I discuss the RG approach is that what I'm going to be doing, the kind of RG I'm going to be doing, is different maybe from what you're familiar with, which is that, what we really want to do, so I'm going to specialize to 1+1 dimensional case. What we really want to do is do some kind of renormalization group on 1+1 dimensional quantum lattice models. Now, typically, what people do or have done is they do a renormalization group on Hamiltonians and wave functions. They work in kind of the Hamiltonian formulation. This is DMRG, which is a very popular method. It's based on that. But what I'm going to do instead is sort of work in a more of a path integral picture. So instead of thinking of a 1+1 dimensional system with a Hamiltonian, I'll think of sort of a 2D model, a 2D sort of classical-like model, where one of the dimensions basically corresponds to time and the other one to space. But I'll allow these models to have, potentially complex weights. So this really is completely equivalent to the case that we're interested in. The reason that I want to do this is that it's just conceptually simpler, and it'll be easier to relate this kind of model to Rea Vireau and things like that, which are formulated in the path integral formulation. Okay, so what I have to do, if I'm going to do this renormalization group, is I have to describe for you some context, like what set of models am I going to do this renormalization group flow on. So the set of models that I'm going to use are something called tensor network models. These are a very general class of lattice models. Special examples of them include things like the Ising model or the Potts model, the six vertex model. In fact, you can show that basically any lattice model with local interactions is a tensor network model. So it's extremely general. And of course, as I said before, it can have complex weights, so it includes other models. How do you define a tensor network model? Well, to define a tensor network model, the first thing you need to give is a lattice. Throughout my discussion, I'm going to use the honeycomb lattice, because that's the simplest lattice in two dimensions. And in addition to a lattice, you need to specify a tensor. The tensor T is going to have three indices, I, j, and k, where I, j, and k run over some range. So that's all you need to specify. You just need to specify a single tensor T, and that will specify some kind of tensor network model. So what is the model? It's very simple. So the way the model is defined is you just put a degree of freedom on each bond of the honeycomb lattice, and so your degrees of freedom can run from 1 to D. So here's, I can run from 1 to D, J can run from 1 to D, P can run from 1 to D, and so on. And then what's the Boltzmann weight? The Boltzmann weight is just given by taking the product of all the tensors, where you sort of put a tensor at each vertex in the honeycomb lattice. So it's very simple. And once you've done this, once you've defined the Boltzmann weight, you can ask what's the partition function. So the partition function would just be given by summing over all the Boltzmann weights. So summing over all these physical degrees of freedom. And if you sum over all these physical degrees of freedom, it's not hard to see what you're really doing is just taking these tensors and contracting them along the bonds. So the partition function is very simple in mathematical terms. It's just take the tensors, contract them, put them in a honeycomb lattice-like geometry and contract them all. Okay. So that's the partition function. And now what we want to do is we want to define some kind of renormalization group flow on this class of models. And we want to show that it will flow to some kind of interesting fixed point that's sort of analogous to the models that people have been talking about.
So the tensor is associated with the sign, not with the bond.
That's right. Yeah, it was hard for me to draw it, but you put a tensor on each site,
okay.
And then the degrees of freedom are on the bonds.
What does this say from the Ising model to more specific?
Yeah, so I'm actually going to give that example, but like for the Ising model, okay, so one, just as an example, imagine you take an Ising model and you put the spins on the plaquettes, just for simplicity. Okay, then the Ising model can be described in terms of domain walls, which live on the bonds. So in other words, if you have this configuration, you have domain walls going here, right? So it's equivalent to describe the Ising model in terms of closed loops, which live on the bonds. And now, all you have to do is, so the Ising model is characterized by closed loops, and they have some tension, because if there's an upspin and a downspin, they don't like that, so it costs them energy. So this basically consists of a loop gas with some tension. And so then to define that, you would just make a tensor T. Let's just let one, index one correspond to no domain wall. Two corresponds to domain wall. And then your tensor T could be something like T T you can see that the twos form closed loops. This just gives you the tension alpha, so it's precisely. But I'll explain during part of this talk how every model can be thought of as a tensor network model in a very sort of generic way. But this is just, if you want to do it in a simple way, this is the simplest way.
Well, see, if you just look at the dual model, this is what Baxter would call an interaction round of face model.
Yeah.
So this would just be the weights would be on triangles on the dual lattice, and we call these IRF models.
Oh, so, okay, yeah, so I'm going to talk about that too. So, like, you put a triangular lattice and you put weights here? You put your tensors here, you mean?
No, you just put a height, say, at the center of every hexagon, and then the interaction will involve the face, the three things
there. I see.
That's assuming this can be reformulated as a dual model, it's identical, which probably it always can be.
Yeah. So I'll show later how every model with local interactions very naturally is a tensor network model. It may seem strange at first, but this is actually the most natural kind of model to think about. So I've defined tensor network models. Now let's think about doing sort of an RG on them. So first I'll do the simplest case, just to get an idea of what we're trying to do. So think about one-dimensional case. So in 1D, our tensors are actually more like matrices. They only have two indices. And so, you know, we have a line of them like this. The partition function is just given by, again, sort of contracting all the tensors, and so that's just the trace of T to the N. So that's the system. And we want to do some kind of RG-like flow, where we coarse grain these tensors. And it's pretty clear how to do that. What we're going to do is we'll just group them together in pairs and form some new, replace each pair by a coarse grain tensor T prime, which is just given by multiplying two of them together. And then we can repeat this process again and again and again, and eventually T will converge to some fixed point T star, which will characterize the system. Okay, so that's the 1D case. Now the question is, can we do this in 2D? And so naively you think, oh, we can do this. We'll just group together tensors around, say, a hexagon, group them all together, and replace them by some coarse grain tensor, say, T prime, right? But you know, this is never going to work, because every time you do this, this tensor had rank 3. Now this tensor has rank 6. If you keep doing this procedure, you can see that the rank will get larger and larger. And this is just a generic property in two-dimensional systems, because the perimeter of a region grows as the region gets bigger. So your rank is going to get bigger and bigger, and it'll be impossible. Of course, we shouldn't be surprised by this, right? Because we know that we can never expect to do an exact renormalization group in two dimensions, because solving generic two-dimensional models is an NP-hard problem. At least I think, I don't know if that's been proven, but I think that's believed. We're never going to be able to do this exactly. So we need some kind of truncation. And what I'm going to describe for you is a way of doing this truncation, which is very much motivated by some of the ideas from, I think, at least the mathematics from topological order and things like that. Okay, so the method is something I'll call a tensor renormalization group method. And basically, this is a coarse graining method where we group together tensors into blocks and then repeat the process. And each coarse graining step has two parts. The first step, is simple, relatively simple. Actually, both steps are very simple. But what's the first step? So the first step is basically what we do is we look at some sort of little subgraph, which looks like this. Has four indices coming out, where we've contracted the bond here, and we try to find a tensor S such that when we contract the tensors along this line, we get approximately this the same result. Now we can't expect to do this exactly, because in general, if we keep S the same rank, the same size as T, because in general, if you think of this as kind of a matrix between these indices and these indices, this matrix has rank D, and this matrix in general has rank D squared. So in general, you're never going to be able to do this exactly. However, as I'll show later, you can do it. It's extremely accurate for even D relatively small. So So the first step is an approximate step, where we this is the truncation step in essence, where we find that we try to approximate this as best as possible.
Okay.
There's something strange about that rank argument, because if you rotate the pictures 90 degrees, it looks like the other one is higher rank.
That's right, but it depends between which two indices. So the point is, this graph has rank D between these two and these two. Between these two and these two. And this will generically have rank D squared between these two and these two. So if we want to do this exactly, we'd have to make this index run from 1 to D squared. And that's basically what we were doing before, when we were keeping all the states, and this is becoming crazy. So okay, so that's the first step. But this is actually very useful, because if we have such a tensor, then this means we can reconnect the lattice at will locally without affecting any of the physics or the partition function or anything else. So in particular, if you choose your reconnections in a nice way, you can say do this reconnection. For example, this is just one example, along say the bonds that I've circled in red. You know. So if you do this reconnection along these bonds, you transform the lattice into, say, this lattice drawn here. And now it's pretty clear what the next step is, because now we can just group together three S's into a coarse grain tensor T prime. And this step is exact. So the first step was approximate, the second step is exact. And then, once we've done both of those things, you can see that we started with a hexagonal lattice, we changed it to this, and then we got to another lattice, which is coarse-grained. It's a square root of 3 times as big or something. And then we could just repeat this procedure again and again.
So if this were the Ising model, how would this differ from the usual way people block spin the Ising model?
That's a very good question. So there's a fundamental difference between I worried about this for a while. I was like, I knew it was much more accurate, but I couldn't figure out exactly what the difference was, but now I think I know. The difference is that this renormalization group transformation is a local transformation. So in other words, when we change, if you look at all the moves, we make the moves are something which preserve the tensor locally here. But if you look at the way that people do block spin, the transformation is, in essence, you know, they do something like, a general renormalization group transformation is something like this. You start with some action like e to the minus s of sigma, and then what you do is you take some function f sigma and tau with the property that when you sum over tau, you get 1, and then you multiply this by f sigma and tau. And then you sum over the sigmas rather than the taus, and you get something like this. Okay, so this is a generic normalization group transformation. And the key point is, and we're doing this kind of transformation too, but the key question is, in what sense is this f function, the point is when we do this f function is somehow defined locally, so when we do this sum, we don't have to we don't have to do anything large. But if you do it in the block spin case, what they have to do is they have to take some very large region that's larger than the correlation length, at least the way that people originally did it, because when you can't sum over all the spins, the spins that you're trying to sum over, the remaining the spins you're trying to sum over interact with each other. So how do you perform the sum? You have to just do it over some large region of size, correlation length. So
that's what people were doing in Monte Carlo, but people
exactly.
Did it by hand, or by the usually it was done in terms of local transformations, but then they have to make the truncation.
Yeah, right. You generate four spin interactions,
but even if you once you generate anything that's like beyond the nearest neighbor interactions, once you generate anything beyond nearest neighbor, you can't do it analytically.
You can, but that's not the issue. You're still integrating other finite analogies of field, so it's local.
No. But so maybe there's a different way of doing it. But if you look at Wilson's paper, for example, you can see that what happens is you're tracing out half the spins, but the spins that you're tracing out, if they say have a interaction with each other, how do you trace them out?
You trace them out, you just
know
the way they're.
But that's equivalent to solving the icing model on those spins.
You can, so that's why you need to turn here.
No. So the point is, what he does is he takes a system that's large,
yeah,
and he just sums over it in a finite system.
Okay.
So in other words, he's going to create errors of order e to the minus whatever the distance is over the correlation length. So then that means to get a good result, you have to do a system that's of size the correlation length, and that's not good. That's basically as bad.
Well,
as
actually, no, actually, these became very accurate. People developed the method. It was developed by Wilson eventually, known as the Monte Carlo normalization rule, which is actually quite accurate. You can get, for instance, for the case of the three-dimensional icing model, you get four decimal places.
You're talking about the critical exponents. I'm saying suppose you want to compute like the magnetization within some point. Then I'm saying
the only thing that is supposed to give you accurate results, if anything, is for critical exponents.
Okay, so that's the difference. So the kind of numerical normalization group I'm talking about is something which works away from a critical point. Actually, it breaks down at the critical point. It's like DMRG. So there's a slight difference. But so this, I'll show you. You can compute things like any observable to high accuracy, like at any point. So this is, the fundamental difference in answer to your question has to do with the locality of this transformation, whether you can perform this sum here exactly in some sense, or whether you have to just take some size like this. Okay, so this is the transformation. And then the idea is we just iterate this, and then we can efficiently compute the partition function. And we can also, in addition to the numerical part of computing the partition function, the fixed point T star will tell us what something about the universal physics in this 1+1 dimensional system. Okay, so what I want to talk about now is I want to give you some kind of physical picture for what's going on, for what T star really means, for why the whole thing works. So what's the physical picture? So physical picture, the first step in the physical picture is to explain to you why an arbitrary lattice model is naturally written as a tensor network model. So suppose we have some arbitrary lattice model, say a square lattice icing model. And let's imagine that we have some big region R, and we want to compute the partition function of this region R. So a natural thing to do to compute it is to just triangulate the region, say into regular triangles like this, okay? And then what you could do is, for each triangle, you can imagine summing over the spins in the interior, and then that will give you some number which depends on the spins of the boundary. So in other words, compute the partition function for each triangle, which will basically be a function of the spins at each of the boundaries. So that's this function psi that I've written here. And now we can think about this function psi as a three-index tensor, where one index corresponds to sort of the spin degrees of freedom on this side, one index corresponds to this side, one index corresponds to this side. And then it's clear that if you go back here, we're gluing together all the triangles, right? So then the total partition function will just be obtained by sort of contracting all these indices. So it'll be a tensor network model. So that's why tensor network models sort of appear very naturally for generic interactions. So now, once we have this picture, we can understand what these transformations are actually doing. Okay, so let's look at the first transformation. So the first transformation was to find this tensor S, which approximately satisfies this quality. So let's look at what does the right-hand side actually mean physically? Well, the right-hand side is, at least in this context that I was telling you, would really represent the partition function of this rhombus-shaped region, and the four indices here will correspond to sort of the spin states along the four sides of this rhombus. So this whole tensor here is basically just the partition function of this region as a function of the boundaries. So now once you have this picture, it's obvious what this tensor S really is physically, or one way to find a solution. We'll just let S be the partition function of an obtuse triangle, so that when you put these two together, you get this. So in other words, what we're really doing in the first step, in some sense, is we're taking knowing what we're knowing the partition function for this triangle, we're computing the partition function for some obtuse triangle like this. So that's what's happening in the first step. We're just changing the triangulation. And now you can also see why there's a truncation, because you know this side is longer than this side. So in general, there'll be more spins along this boundary. So you can never expect it to keep the same number of states. Okay, so that's the first step. The second step also has a simple geometric interpretation. What we're doing in this step is we're just gluing together three obtuse triangles and forming this bigger equilateral triangle. So altogether, if you now look at what's going on in this procedure, what we're really doing is just changing the triangulation via these moves, building up, and the result of these moves that I just chose in a particular way is to start with a small triangle and end up with a bigger one, and then repeat the process again and get larger and larger triangles.
Mm-hmm. So in that picture where you had the three graphs, your original graph, and then via the approximation and the third one, you get the honeycomb again. What I was wondering is, there were edges that were emanating out of the vertices of the hexagon.
Uh-huh.
Were there, so I was just interested in the
picture. Should I go back to that
one? Yeah. Yeah, that one. So out of these edges that are emanating out of the vertices, do you have hexagons on each of those, or do you have a honeycomb structure right back? The last picture, the last that one.
This is the hexagon.
Yeah. So what I'm asking is, out of emanating from each of these out of the vertices, right? Do you have another hexagon attached to each of those? I mean, as you look at this picture in the large.
Yeah, this was just going to form a hexagonal lattice.
So that's what I'm asking. You get the same hexagon.
Yeah, it's exactly the same lattice. Yeah, and you could see it also from this picture, right? Because we're getting back to triangles.
Yeah, that's why.
Right.
Okay.
So really, what we're doing is we're just building up triangles. So it makes a lot of sense geometrically. But the question that you may be asking is, let's think about it a little more carefully. I mean, if you know the way I described it before, everything was done exactly, right? Just exactly. You know, putting together these triangles to form bigger triangles and so on. So the exact tensor psi that corresponds to a very large triangle has a very large, you know, its indices range over some exponentially large set, right? I mean, the indices range over, you know, roughly 2 to the L, where L is the length of each psi. And every time we repeat the process, the triangle gets bigger, and these indices have to range over a bigger and bigger region. And yet we're trying to approximate this somehow or truncate this to a tensor with just some small range running from 1 to d. So I mean, how can that possibly be a reasonable approximation to start with something, the exact result has some huge range, and we're trying to approximate over some small and finite range. So how is this accurate? Well, to understand this, we need to have sort of a physical interpretation for what this partition function or this function psi really means. So what I want to do is argue that psi should be thought of as a quantum ground state, as a quantum wave function on the spins along the boundary. Okay? And what's the argument for this? Well, the argument is that we have our 2D lattice model, sort of classical type mass lattice model, though it might have some complex weights. And we can imagine thinking of this two-dimensional model as a 1+1 dimensional model. That is, we can imagine constructing some kind of Hamiltonian or transfer matrix which generates this 2D model, whose time evolution basically generates this 2D model. Now, in particular, I want to think about something where we imagine that the time direction goes out radially. Okay, so in other words, imagine constructing some kind of transfer matrix which where the time direction goes out radially and the space direction it goes around like this. Then if you imagine doing that, then you can see that this wave function psi is nothing more than the result of applying this time evolution for some long period of time. I mean, it's a large triangle for some long period of time. And so, if you do it for some long period of time, this is an imaginary time, all you get out is the ground state. So the result, so psi should really be thought of as the ground state of some transit matrix or some quantum Hamiltonian, which lives at the boundary. So we should interpret size or think about size as a quantum state. Now, why is that useful to think of it as a quantum state? The reason is that we know quite a bit about one-dimensional quantum states. So let's apply what we know. So the assumption I'm going to make is let's assume that the system, that this classical or this classical lattice model is not critical. It's off criticality. Okay. If it's off criticality, then this Hamiltonian that's generating this is gapped. It has a finite gap. So psi is the ground state of a gapped Hamiltonian. Now, that's very useful because what that means is ground states of gapped Hamiltonians are very weakly entangled. What I mean by that is, if you look at this entanglement entropy that people have been talking about quite a bit, you look at the entanglement entropy of some region of length L within some larger region, and you look at how it scales, it goes to a constant as L goes to infinity. So in gap systems, the entanglement entropy saturates, basically because it makes perfect sense, because entanglement in a gap system is just going to occur in some sort of finite region of order of the correlation length. I don't know how to draw a C. Of order of the correlation length, so as L gets larger and larger, it doesn't matter. The entanglement's just occurring at the boundaries. Okay, so since the system is weakly entangled, that in particular means that you can, that this wave function psi along the boundary of the triangle is weakly entangled, it means we can sort of factorize it into states that live on the three boundaries, right? Because that's what entanglement means. It's the degree to which you can factorize something. So in particular, that means we can factorize it, into something like this with using relatively few states at the three edges. Okay, and when we do this factorization, there'll be some tensor T which tells us how to factorize it. Okay, so now the point is that this is exactly what this means is that even though our exact tensor, was this huge tensor that you could, if you change basis to this special basis that I've drawn here, you can use a much smaller tensor with much smaller range and approximate everything accurately. So that's basically what tensor normalization group is doing. It's an iterative construction of this tensor in the appropriate basis. It's basically just choosing the basis appropriately and truncating in the optimal way. And T star, the fixed point tensor, you should just imagine physically as representing these coefficients here in the limit of an infinitely large triangle. Okay, so that's the physical picture, and it's actually very similar to the physical picture of density matrix renormalization group, and so it actually has the same scaling in terms of accuracy and things like that. In density matrix renormalization group also relies on this sort of weak entanglement property. Okay, so in the critical case, you can ask what happens in the critical case. In the critical case, this is going to break down. Why? Because in the critical case, entropy, as Eduardo mentioned, doesn't go to a constant. It grows logarithmically with the entanglement entropy grows logarithmically with the size of the triangle. So, we'll never be able to factorize it. For any fixed D, it will break down at sufficiently large length scales. Very large length scales, but nonetheless, at sufficiently large length scales, this will break down. So the method breaks down at criticality, but that's the same thing as what happens in other methods. As far as I know, there's no really accurate method that can address criticality.
Why not just let the dimension grow slowly with the system size?
Well, computationally, you have some dimension that you can't go beyond some dimension.
But this is the point with all sort of block spin-esque methods, is of course they break down at the critical point, but you can understand they work away from the critical point. So you just take a crude block spin, and so I think what I was trying to say before is, okay, so you do an exact transformation, and what you'll get is four spin interactions the first time you do it. So I'm just saying, take the square lattice, because it's easier. Take every other point, sum over them all. You'll see you get an effect. This is an exact transformation.
That's exact.
That's exact. you, and you'll generate a four spin
right.
term. Anyway, so let's keep that. That's only one other coupling. You do this again, you'll generate.
No, but you do it again, and
okay.
you suddenly can't do it exactly.
Okay, but wait. But so no, you can do it. You can do an exact again.
No.
You generate eight. Of course you can.
No, because it contains
summing over pluses and minus ones.
No. It's the same thing as solving the icing model.
No,
in
it's
the
not.
First
it's
case.
Just
no,
it's just
no.
summing
no.
over every other spin. It's summing
no,
over
no, because
plus
the spins.
One.
No, the spins that you're summing over interact with each other. See, look.
But not over infinite distance.
No,
these are your blocks are separate and finite.
No. But if there's a sense in which what he's talking about is not exact. Is what I'm saying.
But what I'm saying is it perfectly exact. You first sum over every other site. You get four spin interactions. Now I sum over every other site with the remaining one. You can do it on the computer.
Okay.
You get like eight.
No,
spin
but here's the question. Just 1 second. So. Maybe you're right, but let me just ask you this. So let's start with an icing model which already has the four spin interactions. And let's ask, can we sum over every other spin? So can you sum over every other spin here when these spins, when the spins you're trying to sum over here and here are interacting with each other?
Yeah,
of course.
Sure.
Just
find a number.
No, this one is interacting with this one, is interacting with this one.
Sum
over.
Just
find a number. What you cannot do is a partial.
No, that's equivalent to summing over.
But no, what you can do is something that Wilson describes qualitatively in his original paper, and no one really does, which is the idea that you don't really trace completely over some degrees of freedom. It's only like a partial trace that you can.
Okay, so
that you cannot do.
Okay, well, we'll talk about this afterwards because I don't understand. I know that in Wilson's paper, the only way he could do the calculation.
There is a very large literature after the original Wilson paper. Believe me. Okay, and people. Struggle with this and they get accurate, sometimes they get accurate.
Okay, in any case, even if this is true, this
yeah.
is interesting.
Yeah.
This would be very interesting because we need to understand why DMRG and these types of methods are extremely accurate, but this method isn't. I thought it was because of locality, but maybe I'm wrong.
There's no locality.
But
the problem
we'll
is
talk about it afterwards.
The problem is truncation.
Well, there's something, okay, so maybe the truncation isn't being done in a correct way. Maybe
well, it's an uncontrolled approximation.
But there's definitely, practically speaking, there's
right,
a
yeah,
fundamental difference.
Yeah, I started this discussion. Since sharing the session, I better let you continue your.
Just so the audience knows, it's a fact that only these kinds of normalization groups, these kinds of entanglement-based normalization groups, can do things accurately away from a critical point. That's definitely true. I mean, that's well established. I mean, density matrix normalization group is the only, and analogs are the only way that people have successfully done this. But we can continue afterwards. We'll talk afterwards. Okay, so an example is the triangle lattice icing model, which I already described. And if you do it in that case, this is just an example of what you find. You know, here's the magnetization, say, as a function of temperature, basically. And you can see that it agrees with the exact result. I don't know, gives you TC, say, to four decimal places, and agrees everywhere except for in a very narrow range near the critical point where this breakdown occurs.
What is D here?
D is the size of the truncation, how big the tensor is. You keep from 1 to 4 or 1 to 8.
So this is like the number of spins in your block?
Yeah.
The size of the block spin?
No. D is the range that I runs over from 1 to D. Okay.
I thought it was 3 here. The only coordination number is 3.
The coordination number is 3, but then each index runs over some range, 1 to D. And you increase D to make it more and more accurate.
So I understand. You have one spin per site. I don't see where
it's
spin.
Oh, no. Okay. The spin runs from 1 to D. The spin is degree of freedom. No. You start with, okay, so what you do is you would start with a model where it has d possible states, but all the Boltzmann weight is for, you know, up, you know, first two states, 1 and 2, and then all the other states have Boltzmann weight 0.
So
you
but don't
then
force
when you
the system to look like an icing spin?
No, you force it to look like some system with range 1 from 1 to d.
I see.
By the way, Mike, you know that triangular lattice easing model has been solved exactly.
Yeah, I'm aware of that, but they actually cannot. Okay, that's definitely true.
So, I mean, the reason actually an exact.
I know they can't actually solve the equations, but yeah, I saw what you're talking about. That's true. But you can do any lattice model. Now, I'm not claiming that this is new in a sense, because people have ways of solving 1D quantum system using the normalization group methods, just like this DMRG. This is a classical analog of it, and the reason I'm presenting is because I think it's easier to generalize it to higher dimensions, and also because you can see the connection with, I'm going to try to show connection more with these topological issues. Okay, so now we get to the question that we want to understand, which is understanding the fixed points of this RG flow, and using that to classify all the different possible universality classes that you can get in two dimensions, one plus one dimension. So if we just write down the equations that we need to solve two equations to find the fixed point tensors. And you know, ideally, it would be nice to just be able to solve these algebraically, just find all the solutions. However, I don't know where to do that. So what I want to do instead is give a physical derivation or ansatz for the solutions to these equations. So how do we do that? Well, physical derivation is simple. It rests on one assumption. I'm going to assume, for simplicity, that these fixed points that we're talking about correspond to phases with no long-range order, because I'm not interested in simple symmetry breaking. I'm looking for other types of order, other types of universality classes. So we'll assume that. Now let's recall what T star really means. T star, as I said before, is basically tells you how to factor this quantum ground state into the three edges. Okay. So now here's where the physical aspect comes in. Physically, we expect that each one of these states, I, can be labeled physically by two labels, one corresponding to this part of the edge and one corresponding to this part of the edge, the two sides. Why is that? Well, because physically, if you have an arbitrary, say, 1D system with local interactions, you expect that, you know, once you specify sort of the boundary condition, you know, what's going on near this boundary and what's going on near this boundary, the state in the center is uniquely specified, given some range here, you know, of order, say, the correlation length, the state inside is uniquely specified. So by that logic, we expect that we could, in the appropriate basis, we can label these states by degrees of freedom that correspond to this, an index which corresponds to degrees of freedom here, and an index which corresponds to degrees of freedom here. Okay, and we can do that for the other edges as well. Okay, and and then if we assume again that there's no long range order, then we know that these degrees of freedom and these degrees of freedom are all uncoupled with each other. They only couple near the corners. So with that ansatz, our physical derivation is that the fixed point tensor should be of this form. Basically, it should just involve some coupling between these indices, and these indices. Geometrically, I'm saying the fixed point tensor can be written in this sort of double line notation that I've drawn here. So are these actually solutions? Yes, they are. You can plug them back in into these equations. These equations here, and you can see very easily that they are solutions. So that's good. We didn't go totally wrong following physics intuition. But we have a problem. We have too many solutions. This is very strange. I mean, look, we have lambda can be essentially, you know, continuously varied lambda, we still get a solution. So that's very strange, because we only expect a finite number of universality classes, or a discrete number of universality classes for, you know, a particular system. And yet we're getting this continuum of them. So what's going on? What's going on is that our coarse graining transformation, in a sense, is incomplete. We haven't completely removed the short distance physics. So the fixed point, even though we've done all this coarse graining, and we've removed a lot of short distance physics, there's still some information about the lattice scale physics which is contained in the fixed point. And it's this information which corresponds to all the different sort of continuously varying fixed points.
When you rescale, do I think of this as rescaling the coarse fixed point? Because you showed us magnetization, for example. Am I going to rescale to?
No, there's no rescaling. It's just it's really a decimation procedure.
So shouldn't I really think of each initial condition, like the initial whatever the conditions are, whatever magnetization?
Exactly. Each magnetization would correspond to a different fixed point. And in general, it's not just magnetization, like the geometric picture for what's going on you could actually see it in the previous slide. But that's you're absolutely right. Magnetization would be an example of some short distance physics that remains. But in general, even if you don't have long range order, there's short distance physics, which comes from this lambda. I mean, what was lambda representing? Lambda was representing the short distance entanglement at these corners. So basically the point is that, let me see if I can draw a picture. The point is that, you know, while we're building up these triangles into bigger and bigger triangles, like this, the triangles are getting very big, right? But there's still some short distance physics which remains, which is at the corners. So all these scales are getting very large, but there's still some entanglement around the corners, and that's going to depend on short distance correlations between spins and so on. And this is actually also true when people do these other RG methods. DMRG again, the short distance entanglement remains. And actually, it's a very interesting question as to if there's a way to kind of coarse grain in a complete way where you get rid of this. Because if you could, you could address all kinds of problems that we don't know how to address at the moment. So there's some short distance physics remains. What does that mean in terms of our physical picture? That means that we don't actually have fixed points, but we have our fixed surfaces or hypersurfaces. The point is that, you know, each fixed point will contain some universal information and some non-universal information. The universal information, each surface will have different universal information, but the points on each surface will differ in some kind of short distance physics. So, you know, this point might have some magnetization, this point might have another magnetization. These are all in the same universality class, though they don't differ in anything universal.
Don't you expect the topological order to be what actually doesn't change these points? I mean,
exactly. So these points are all in the same universality class. They have the same topological work. So that's the next question.
This is a classical Ising model. Where is the topological order?
No, so there is no topological order. I'll explain that there's... So the next thing I want to do is classify all the fixed surfaces and all the universality classes so you can see what are the possibilities.
Short distance physics is non-topological, certainly, and you want to isolate the topological.
Short distance physics isn't of interest, yeah, regardless of whether we're interested. We only want to know what are the different fixed surfaces, because that tells you the different universality classes. The different points on the fixed surface, as I said, they just differ by entanglement near here or something. It's not like, you know, they're both they're in the same phase. You know, this point and this point are in the same phase. You can go from one to the other without a phase transition. So how do we do that? Well, let's think about the cases. So the first case to consider, since we're here, is let's consider the simplest case, no symmetry. So we impose no symmetry whatsoever on our lattice model. We just consider a generic lattice model. So if we have no symmetry, then there's no reason why we can't continuously change lambda to some kind of trivial lambda without a phase transition. Because you can look at the lambdas are totally uncoupled. These degrees of freedom are totally uncoupled, so you can continuously change it. You can see there's no phase transition. There's no, because you can exactly see that the partition function or whatever else it is.
But
so
then it will have nothing to do with the ground state.
Sorry?
Then the wave function will have nothing to do with the ground state of the system on the triangle after this deformation.
That's right. But it's in the same universality class. What we're doing here is we're doing this. We're taking lambda, which is some point here, and we're moving it to maybe a special point here, which is particularly simple. We're just doing this. So the end result is a different model, but it's in the same universality class.
Yeah, I don't see why that's moving along the surface. I thought you had to take the solutions to the equations on each edge of the triangle and then see how the ground state wave function was formed as a tensor product to these
solutions.
You basically build up your solution space in the triangle as a tensor product of three edge spaces.
Oh, yeah.
And then had to solve for those coefficients lambda.
Right.
So I would imagine this I don't see how setting that product equal one would
I'm moving from one lambda. I'm saying continuously change from one lambda to another lambda. Any lambda is on that surface.
Okay.
any lambdas on that surface, different lambdas correspond to different points on the surface. So I'm just saying you can get from any lambda to any other lambda. That's all I'm saying. They're all in the same universality class.
I agree with that, but what's this number one doing?
Oh, that's just the simplest lambda. Lambda identically equals one for all indices. I just picked the simplest. That, maybe that's confusing. You can get from any lambda to any other lambda. The point is, there's only one surface. There aren't two distinct surfaces.
Okay.
So there's only one universality class. So without symmetry breaking, there's only one kind of order in one dimension. There's nothing that interesting. However, there is an interesting thing that can happen if you impose some kind of symmetry. So what I mean by imposing some kind of symmetry is, you imagine you can impose, this would be equivalent to imposing some kind of symmetry, local global symmetry on your, say, spin chain. And the way you would impose it is you impose that the tensor, Tijk, is invariant under some kind of transformation. Some kind of transformation, you know, I goes to Oijj. And this tensor will transform in some way. You could restrict your attention to tensors which are invariant under certain symmetry groups. That's equivalent to restricting your attention to spin models with a certain symmetry. So suppose we do that, then depending on the symmetry group, you'll get different possibilities for universality classes. So it turns out that you can classify the possibilities, and I won't say too much about it except to tell you what the result is, which is that the fixed surfaces turn out to be in one-to-one correspondence with basically, roughly speaking, projective representations. So these are irreducible representations of G that may be projective. You know, they may have an extra minus one or something, such that rho tensor rho is a representation of G. So it turns out that each different, up to some equivalence relation, each different projective representation will give you a different universality class. Now, what's the simplest example of this? Let's take G equals SO3, and let's take, so this is like a spin chain, right? That has SO3 symmetry. So that basically means it's an integer spin chain. That's important, because half-integer spin chains have SU2 symmetry. And let's take rho equals spin 1/2, the spin 1/2 representation. This is a projective representation of G with the property that when you tensor it with itself, it's a true representation. So this will correspond to a particular non-trivial universality class, a particular fixed surface. Which one is it? This is really the Haldane spin 1 chain. It's a famous example of something that can happen in one dimension that's it's in a new universality class. And it turns out that, you know, what I've basically said here is, from this derivation, it seems that the only possibilities are basically some kind of generalizations of the Haldane spin chain, which is actually somewhat interesting and I think perplexing, because at least in the sort of mathematical literature or even in the high energy physics literature, there seems to be many more sort of mathematical possibilities for topological phases in 1+1 dimensions than there are physical realizations. In contrast with the 2+1 dimensional case, where the two definitions seem to be, you know, whatever mathematicians consider a possible phase is one that you can actually realize. But here, seems as though the relation is less clear.
So for Z2, what's the answer?
For Z2, there are no projective representations. So the only kind of order you can have, other than long range order, is trivial.
Yes.
So we're talking about one plus one dimensions.
Right, but here in principle, this is the way you set it out is for studying symmetry rate, conventional symmetry rate.
No, I want to study all types of universality classes, but I'm neglecting symmetry breaking for simplicity because I don't want to worry about the correlations between. I think in essence the full answer is you can have either this, or you can have symmetry breaking, or you can have some kind of combination of the two. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to get into that. I actually haven't done that analysis. But so this is the kind of answer you get. So this thing is you will get. So what I want to do with the rest of the talk time is explain trying to do a similar program in 2+1 dimensions. So I want to talk about generalization to 2+1 dimensions. And And hopefully here, it'll become even more clear what the connection is with all the concepts of topological order, and Terea Viro models that people have been talking about. Now I put question mark after this, because I'm not sure about this. This is like a speculation about generalization. So I don't know if this works. I don't know if it's wrong. I need feedback. But I think it's interesting, so I want to tell you about it. So what's the generalization? Well, let's think about what we had in 1 plus 1 dimension. Well, 1 plus 1 dimension, if you think about things in kind of the dual language, what we really had was instead of thinking about it as a honeycomb lattice, we could equally well have thought of it as this regular triangular lattice, where we put a tensor T at the center of every triangle, and then these degrees of freedom lived on the edges of the triangle. So in other words, the degrees of freedom lived on the edges of the triangle, and we had some kind of Boltzmann weight associated with each triangle, and then we take the product of all these Boltzmann weights, and that's the weight of configuration. So in the dual language, it's just a triangular lattice with tensors living at each triangle and physical degrees of freedom living on the edge. So it's useful to think of the dual language, because then it's clear, potentially, how to do it in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So what you want to do, and I don't know exactly how to do this, it seems to me, is instead of using some kind of triangular lattice, a triangulation of 2 dimensions, you want to use a triangulation of 3 dimensions. Now you can't, unfortunately, pack tetrahedra, regular tetrahedra, in 3 dimensions, so it will never be quite as simple as it was in the 2-dimensional case. But there are packings of regular packings of tetrahedra in 3 dimensions. Instead of having a tensor corresponding to each triangle, you would want one corresponding to each tetrahedra, and the degrees of freedom now will live on the faces of the tetrahedra. And again, you'll multiply all these factors together to get the Boltzmann weight of some configuration. Okay, now the next question is, how do we do our RG transformation? Well, in the 1 plus 1 dimensional case, the RG transformation was done by these changes of triangulation. And so we want to do exactly the same thing in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So we want to take 2 tetrahedra, glue them together, and then try to split it into 3 tetrahedra on the 3 sort of sides of this shape. This is a move which I guess a number of people have been talking about. This move from gluing together 2 tetrahedra, I think Greg Cooperberg mentioned it, and splitting it into 3. The other move is to glue together 4 tetrahedra corresponding to the 4 faces into one bigger one. So again, I don't know, but it seems to me that in principle one could make such moves, build up larger and larger tetrahedra and apply the same kind of analysis. Now what kinds of fixed points would we expect? Using the same kind of physical analysis which I suggested before, it's natural to think that that we can label the states, these physical states, which are sort of going to correspond to quantum states on the faces, by degrees of freedom that live at the boundaries. So we want to label them by 6, and for this phase, we want to label them by sort of 6 degrees of freedom, corresponding to the three areas near the vertex and then the 3 edges. And then we can imagine doing the same thing for all the other faces. And then, using this physical ansatz, we expect that the degrees of freedom near the vertices are only correlated with each other. They don't, if we assume no long-range order, they have no correlation. Different vertices have no correlation since they're separated by a long distance. On the other hand, the edges here, I'm going to assume can have arbitrary correlation, because there's no way, if you look carefully into this physical argument, there's no way of arguing that these degrees of freedom can really be thought about as local spin-like degrees of freedom. These are actually more like non-local degrees of freedom that have to be measured, that really live on the whole edge. So it doesn't really live at the center of the edge. It's really on the whole edge.
So what did this compare time?
I'm sorry?
Are these compared in time?
Again, time is one of the 3 directions. Yeah.
I mean, because it makes more physical sense to make it a continuous variable, maybe it's a continuous transformation of that instead.
Well, to me, it's typical when people talk about lattice field theories, they often discretize both space and time so that it
but
looks
then you do some sort
totally
of
symmetric.
Scaling, an isotropic scaling, right?
I want to do it isotropically, that's the point.
Yeah.
It just makes things simpler. Okay, so now let's take this as our ansatz, and then let's ask, what is the what are the fixed points? If we assume the fixed points are of this form, and we plug this back in to the RG transformations, you can substitute it back in the RG transformations, and the fixed point constraints are precisely, at least the first fixed point constraint would be precisely this kind of pentagon identity, and there'll be another one corresponding to the other moves. So, but again, there'll be no constraint on lambda. So again, you'll have this sort of fixed surface where lambda can change continuously, but f is sort of quantized.
So the technical issues, the Westwood and Wilshire buses here, so
okay.
We're seeing if they can hold on for
okay,
a few
I have one more slide.
Okay, I saw that.
Okay. So this is exactly the constraints for the Terea-Varroa string net model. So so at least if it's suggestive that if you were to do these transformations, the fixed points would be precisely these models up to some, again, sort of non-universal component has to do with these vertices. Okay, so in conclusion, I've tried to show you that that this approach gives you an understanding of emergent of how topological order can emerge, how this special mathematical structure comes about at long distances. I've showed you how you can classify fixed points, and I've argued that this is a powerful method. Of course, there are other methods in 1+1 dimension, so I'm not so, this is not necessarily so important. However, what I think is interesting is whether this could work in 2+1 dimensions, both as an understanding of topological order and even more importantly, or equally importantly, as a numerical method, because as I said, these methods could solve, don't have a sign problem, so they can solve any kind of quantum problem. So I think it's an interesting interplay between thinking about these topological moves and trying to solve this numerical issue. Anyway, thank you for your attention.